Welcome to episode 138 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor, sort of, emeritus, retired at the University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Much is happening in the world, and both in a positive and negative way, but I thought I would call out that this is the time of year when the Nobel Committee gives out the Nobel Prizes for medicine and everything else. But I wanted to point out that there was an Ig Nobel Prize that was given in medicine to 8 researchers who did this really neat cadaver study to see if the number of nostril hairs are the same on each side. In case you were dying to know, on average, there's 112 on the right side and 122 on the left.
And as you get older, that number keeps rising, I'll add. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or poems. If you want to get all the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get one every day, plus a great primary care reference. And we just launched our new update. Very excited to have you check that out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. In fact, we rather criticize quite a few products out there, so we're sort of anti-endorsers. So for a nominal fee, you can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy, IAFP.com. Click on their education webpage. This week, we're going to discuss viral loads and the risk of HIV transmission, tetracyclines and dental staining in kids, metformin to prevent long COVID in obese and overweight adults, and the effectiveness of terbinafine pulse therapy for ugly toenails. Kate, take it away.
Yeah, I have an interesting study this week. So this was a systematic review with no meta-analysis, but these authors searched multiple databases, conference proceedings, the whole gray literature, registries, to identify studies that was looking at sexual transmission of HIV among serodiscordant couples. They ultimately found 8 studies with more than 7,700 serodiscordant couples, 25 different countries. They included both same-sex and opposite-sex couples. The authors found that overall studies were at low risk of bias. As I mentioned, the studies were quite different in methodology. There was a cross-sectional study, a case-controlled, some cohort studies, and a couple of randomized controlled trials. But the authors decided not to pool the data, so this was a systematic review without a meta-analysis. What they were looking at was to find what was the level of HIV viral load at which there was no transmission, couple-to-couple or partner-to-partner transmission of HIV. What they found was that in 3 studies, when the viral load was less than 200 copies per ml, there was no sexual transmission of HIV. 4 of the studies found none, again, when it was considered to be adequately suppressed, which was generally considered to be less than 200 copies per ml. And in 2 of those studies, 80% and about 90% of the transmissions occurred when the viral loads exceeded 10,000 copies per ml. The authors found only 2 cases of transmission when the out of all of those, when the viral load was less than 1,000 copies per ml. And in both of those cases, the viral load was actually not known to be adequately suppressed at all. Measured levels were around 800 before and after transmission. So this study is another in really a series of studies that confirm that when the viral load is less than 1,000 copies, or what we consider sort of undetectable, that HIV is probably not transmissible via sexual activity. And this supports the NIH's U equals U campaign, which I'm sure you've all heard about, but that is the undetectable equals untransmissible campaign. It's intended to reinforce the need for consistently available and accessible antiretroviral treatment as a prevention strategy for HIV. In other words, effective treatment of HIV leads to non-detectable viral levels, which means HIV is not only less likely to cause complications for the patient, but it's actually going to prevent further transmission. So again, as a prevention strategy, kind of a win-win situation. So remember, U equals U, undetectable equals untransmissible. Nifty little study from The Lancet. Henry, what do you think?
Thanks for bringing this back around, Kate. I dug back in our archives because I thought we had covered this a few times, and it turns out that the last time that we covered this was in episode 32, back in November of 2019. We've talked about these frequently in like the editor's choice section of our courses. And as you point out, this is something that's been a fairly consistent finding. I'm pleased that they chose not to do a meta-analysis given the methodologic diversity in these studies. I think their big caveat here is that we assume that there are monogamous relationships here. And in that study in 2019, that was also a Lancet paper, more than a third of the partners had additional partners. And so we do need to at least be aware that we need to promote either monogamous behaviors or that when they are wandering from their relationship, that they still need to be using condoms.
Mark has a comment.
Yeah, I disagree. Henry, I think that actually they could have probably combined a couple of the studies, the three cohorts, the placebo arm of the control trial, maybe even the randomized trials. I mean, those are prospective cohort designs. Seems like
they probably lacked imagination.
Well, I don't know. Or maybe there were other differences in terms of inclusion criteria, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's I just have to disagree with you, Henry. Gary, any final comments?
Well, regardless, Mark, does that actually have an effect on the results?
No.
Okay, thank you.
But it still made me feel better to disagree with him.
When you guys talk nerdy, I'll tell you. Just a couple of things. I the way I look at this, this again just reinforces, and I'm really bad at this, but universal screening, because we have so many effective treatments now. And I reflect back, since I believe I'm the oldest one of this four, back when HIV was a terminal illness. And it's just one of the, if not the top, medical story of my medical career from the early 1980s to now, from going to a death sentence to one that's just basically a chronic disease that's we've got effective treatment for. And now we've got evidence of public health, important evidence for transmissibility, both with PrEP as well as with, active treatment with suppressing viral loads.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat with you. I mean, I remember third year rotation in medical school at the VA hospital in Ann Arbor and having a patient who eventually died of complications of HIV, and how we would gown up and glove and mask and not really know fully the transmissibility. And obviously, I agree with you completely. It's been a huge success story. Kate, it's your turn to do the quiz.
Yeah,
you have a lot of options today, too.
Keep going with the quiz. Short question today. Which of the following was associated with an increased risk of dementia in a large prospective cohort study? Was it A, a low vitamin D level, B, high HDL level, C, low HDL level, D, low LDL level, E, all of the above, F, none of the above, or G, Gary style, more than one of the above may be correct. Stay tuned for the answer.
Thanks, Kate. Henry, tell us about tetracyclines. Bust another myth for us.
Yeah, so here's another iconoclastic study, or potentially iconoclastic. It asks the question, do tetracyclines stain teeth or affect dental health in children younger than 8 years of age? This was published in Pediatrics in July by Ravindra and colleagues. And they did a really nice job of trying to search multiple databases, multiple other sources, including Google Scholar, dissertation abstracts, and the like, to identify any kind of study published in the English language that evaluated antibiotic exposure before the age of 8 and that reported information about teeth, including staining, caries, or any other developmental defects in the enamel. They find only five studies, 206 children, and the risk of bias was fairly low in three of those studies, so reasonable quality data. They did not pool the information, but what they found was that there was really no overall relationship between doxycycline use and teeth staining, and these were all relatively short term. There was another study of 39 children with minocycline that showed also no effect on tooth color. Tetracycline, given at doses that were typically higher than what we usually use today, was associated with staining, but not in the lower doses, and certainly nothing in relationship to changes in the dental enamel or dental caries. So this is a potential practice changer that if you've got a child less than 8 years of age, doxycycline and minocycline are probably okay for short-term use. I think the jury may still be out with regards to tetracycline. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I mean, I think minocycline with only 39 kids, the confidence interval of that is 3/39 would be the upper bound. So there's still a chance you could have some problems with it. But certainly doxy seems safe for the short term. That's great. Kate?
I have two questions. I first want to know what made us think that it would cause tooth issues in the first place. And this is, I don't know, years and year, decades of medical knowledge that we've, you know, one study it took to now be like, never mind. And I guess I also would be really curious to know, okay, so now we've got decent evidence that says it doesn't work. I'd be curious to know, how long does it take for us to start prescribing doxy to kids?
Good luck.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever happen now.
It won't happen.
Yeah. Have you ever prescribed doxy to a kid?
This problem will be solved generation. What is it?
You know, it reminds me of the chlorampheniclol. Yeah, the chlorampheniclol story when I was coming up in training. You know, 1 in 50,000 developed aplastic anemia. I mean, nobody prescribes for chlorampheniclol. It's an actually wonderful antibiotic. It's got all kinds of, you know, utility. But just because of, you know, 1 in 50,000 having, an extremely bad outcome, you know, it's totally affected the use of this.
Yep. And Kate, to answer your question about, this was taught to me when I was a medical student. So, you know, that's way back in the dark ages. So this is ancient lore.
Right. That's what I mean. I think. So what's that going to take, you know, four generations?
Was it etched on your tablets? Was it etched into the tablets that you had? The
cuneiform?
Stone tablets. Yeah. All right. My turn. Overweight and obese adults with symptomatic COVID treated with metformin are less likely to develop long COVID. It's called the COVID Out Study. It was in Lancet Infectious Disease 2023. Some long S1473. Bramante was the name of the first author. So yeah, they asked the question. This was it's been a while since we've had any COVID studies, but I did think this was interesting, particularly as our focus shifts more away from acute COVID, more toward the long-term complications and implications. So this was a platform trial, which means they evaluated several different treatments at once. It was funded by foundations and government agencies, and they included 1,126 overweight or obese adults with symptomatic lab-confirmed COVID-19. And they were randomized to get metformin plus ivermectin, metformin plus fluvoxamine, metformin plus placebo, ivermectin plus placebo, that's the unlucky group, and fluvoxamine plus placebo, or placebo plus placebo. That, I guess that may be the really unlucky group. But not getting ivermectin is probably a good thing. Ivermectin was given for 3 days, metformin for 2 weeks, titrated to 1,500 milligrams daily, so pretty substantial dose. Fluvoxamine was given for 2 weeks as well, titrated to 50 milligrams twice daily. So the main outcome of the study was severe COVID-19 by day 14, but they did pre-specify secondary outcome that was development of long COVID as diagnosed by a medical provider during 6 months of follow-up. And that's one of the limitations that I'm sure we'll discuss is, you know, how did they get that label and how reliable is that? Overall, 6.2% of adults who got metformin and 10.3% getting placebo had a diagnosis of long COVID for a number needed to treat of about 25. And of course, neither ivermectin or fluvoxamine had any effect on the likelihood of long COVID. The authors don't report any found no difference in adverse events between the treatment groups. So bottom line, among overweight or obese adults with acute symptomatic COVID-19, treatment with metformin, 1,500 milligrams per day for 2 weeks, reduced the frequency of developing self-reported long COVID 6 months after infection. Now, there were several secondary outcomes. You know, the questions about the mechanism, I would call this hypothesis generating. Also, the question, is it only overweight or obese adults? So still lots of questions, but an interesting study. Gary?
Yeah, absolutely interesting. I think as you point out too, in some of your written comments, it's incredibly safe and incredibly cheap, and it's been around for a long time. The mechanism is really something I was wondering about when I was reading through this study. I guess ultimately, when you say that this is a hypothesis generating study, this was a randomized controlled trial, and so I'm wondering at what point, what other evidence are you going to need in order to maybe consider using this, given its apparent efficacy, but its safety and its cost as well? I mean, is this something that you personally would be talking to your patients about? There's a 1 in 25 chance that you're going to get, 1 in 25 chance
1 in 10, you can reduce it to 1 in 25. Yeah. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, it seems reasonable. I mean, I think I would like, I'm curious about the non-overweight, non-obese adults. Not that that would affect me, but I'm interested in that group as well. And, I mean, there were multiple secondary outcomes. The mechanism they posit that there's some in vitro antiviral effects and anti-inflammatory effects that have been seen. They have all sorts of possible reasons, but that's just kind of like trying to say why the stock market went up today or went down today. It's, you know, you can always find a reason for it going in either direction mechanistically. I think it would be interesting, and I would certainly consider it. I think as you point out, the benefits and the harms are, you know, pretty clear. Kate, are you ready to jump on the bandwagon?
I mean, safety-wise, I agree. I don't see a big risk of harm. I'm not sure I quite buy there. Well, maybe it's anti-inflammatory or something, mm-hmm. Right. Because that was what they said about fluvoxamine too. And I really don't buy that. But now I think I'm evidence-based in saying I really don't buy that. At first, there was sort of a big bandwagon for some of these other ones. I just don't get it, I guess, and I would rather sort of at least have some biologic plausibility before saying I'm all on board with metformin for yet another indication. I really do wonder what made them say, like, you know, next time you have a contagious infectious disease, let's try giving you a diabetes drug. Like, what made them do that? You know, you were going to randomize you to a anti-infective that does not work for the condition that we're giving you, antidepressant medicine or a diabetes medicine. And nobody in the study was like, could I please have a medicine that works for the actual thing that I'm being treated for?
Yeah, so and these patients weren't being given Paxlovid. They weren't being given things that we do know are effective. And I don't recall seeing the impact of Paxlovid on long COVID. I don't recall. I don't know if you guys have seen anything. I haven't. That would be a good question. Henry, final comments?
Yeah, so first comment is, Gary, the more analyses that you do, the greater the chance of identifying a random association. So multiple subgroup analyses, I think, are problematic. And I think Mark's caution note as being hypothesis generating, requiring confirmation with other studies. So this is one of those few times where Mark and I actually agree. Especially in light of some of the other methodologic issues in this paper. So the first big one is that it was self-report that a clinician told me I had long COVID. Now, granted, clinician diagnosis is currently the standard. We don't have diagnostic standards for this. But they didn't even bother checking the patient's medical records to confirm that there was a diagnosis of long COVID in the patient's chart. They didn't have an independent panel evaluate each of the individual's symptom constellation to confirm that, yeah, this sounds like long COVID. So the big deal here is that, I'm mentioning all of these issues because that raises all kinds of potential biases in this evaluation. Oh, by the way, stay tuned. We might be coming close because there was just a recent report in Nature that suggests that the combination of immune phenotyping and unbiased machine learning methods. I don't know what that means, but that can help to identify long COVID. So maybe we've got some help on the way.
I mean, I think machine learning methods are inherently biased because they learn from biased data or, you know, the inherent biases that are in the data. So I'm not sure about that, but, fingers crossed. Or as they say here in Germany, Daumendrücken, I think they say. Yep. Anyway, good stuff. And we will keep an eye on that and see if any more studies pop up about metformin. Gary, you're going to tell us about nasty toenails.
Yeah, this is a surprisingly common concern among my patients. And I'm going to make a wild guess that amongst our listeners' patients as well. It is generally... I would say a month doesn't go by, and I'm a part-time clinician, where I don't have a patient coming in who wants something done about this. So for me, this was a very relevant study. And because it confirmed my previous practice, I think it's a great study. Okay, so it was the title was Relative Impact of Traditional versus Newer oral antifungals, and I might say these newer antifungals I've never heard of. I'm not sure I can pronounce them, for dermatophyte toenail onychomycosis. It's a network meta-analysis, and I'm sure a lot of readers subscribe to the British Journal of Dermatology, so this would just be a review for most of them. So a network meta-analysis that compared these individual oral antifungal regimens. They used and it'd be interesting to get your comments when I'm done talking here, the surface under the cumulative ranking curve, SUCRA. So maybe that's well known to the smarter people on this podcast here. But that was what they looked at, which was apparently some type of a measure of the likelihood that a regimen is more likely to be effective or more likely to cause harm. So they calculated the SUCRA score. The higher it is, the better the therapeutic impact of a given drug for each of these three or four different medications. They had 21 different studies. The quality of the studies was generally moderate to low. Most of them had a moderate to high risk of bias, stated another way. And when they looked at the complete cure rate at 1 year, remember, it takes about 9 months for a toenail to grow out. So 1 year seems like an appropriate period of time. What they found was 250 milligrams of terbinafine once daily for 3 months, followed by a three-month kind of a washout period where they were not on therapy, followed by another 4 weeks of 250 milligrams daily of terbinafine, had a SUCRA score of almost 83%. Now, they actually looked at studies in which the treatment period was 8 weeks and followed by an 8 week period of no therapy, followed by another 4 weeks. The SUCRA score was almost identical. It was 80% basically. They compared this to several other drugs, soaconazole, oteseconazole, and I think albaconazole, drugs I've never heard of. Some of these I don't even think are available in the United States. Found that the terbinafine, which is about $6 for a month prescription, was most effective. These other drugs, some of which are available, you can look at them on GoodRx, were just crazy expensive, $2,700 for a month. One was almost $700 for a month, et cetera, et cetera. So long story short, it's something I've been practicing for a number of years, just this pulse therapy with terbinafine, and it's nice to see some evidence here. Which I don't think is new evidence, but it certainly is evidence that I think confirms previous studies that terbinafine is actually highly effective, doesn't seem to be very toxic, and is dirt cheap.
All good. Kate?
Yeah, what kind of adverse events were they studying? Was it like the catastrophic hepatic failure that we worry about, or was it like nausea?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know specifically. I do know that they were looking at hepatic function during part of this part of these studies. And again, when they looked at the prevalence, I don't know that I wrote that down here. So I don't know exactly how many quote adverse effects they saw with terbinafine. I'd have to look that up.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that they studied both clinical cure and mycologic cure, because I almost don't care about mycologic cure as long as the clinical cure is there. I guess I just assume that, you know, if it's growing out and looks healthy, that it's probably mycologically fine.
Yeah, the only reason is that the peer reviewers for the poems ask that I put it in there. That's the only reason it's in there, because I don't care either. But hey, whatever.
Eric Lindblom, yeah. Wherever you are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Damn you.
So you know my feelings about this topic. We've talked about it.
You think it's silly. You think it's silly that people are.
I do. This is a cosmetic condition. You know,
and having this argument with you.
So cure goes from having an ugly looking toenail to a pretty looking toenail. So the big whole question about all of this is, why would you spend anything? $2,700 a month is ridiculous. So I just okay. So I
you don't even know what a peep-toed sandal is.
You're right. But again, that's a cosmetic condition. So the big question that, you know, so I did go back last night and did a quick search in PubMed to see, okay, Henry, what am I missing? You know, real infection, soft tissue infection, cellulitis, that type of thing. What's the natural history of untreated onychomycosis? PubMed, 36 million references, and doing a keyword search on onychomycosis and natural history. Do you know how many hits I showed up? Zero. Okay. Nobody knows what's the natural history of this when you just leave the stupid things alone.
I just know my dad's became about an inch thick.
Yeah, they never get better. That's what happened.
Anyway,
Do we really?
You should have gone to the TikTok to find out what happens when people like to wear flip-flops all summer.
Yeah.
Hey, nobody wants to look at that.
I just like the fact that what was new for me here was the drug holiday part of it, the 12. I love that term, by the way, drug holiday, which means something very different to my patients when I say putting you on a drug holiday. They think they're going to Thailand or something. But no, you know, but that interval, it makes a lot of sense if you think about it, that 12-week interval of no drugs and then another month to boost it. I like that.
Why does that make sense to you, Mark?
It just seemed clever, because I just like it. I just like it. All right, Kate, time to wrap it up here with the quiz.
All right, quiz answer. The question again was, which of the following was associated with an increased risk of dementia in a large prospective cohort study? Low vitamin D, high HDL, low HDL, low LDL, all or none of the above, or more than one of these may be correct. So the correct answer here is both a high and a low HDL levels were associated with dementia in this prospective cohort of more than 180,000 patients, average age of 69, who were followed for about 15 years. This was interesting too. LDL had no association with dementia risk, unless you took a statin, in which case a higher LDL slightly increased the risk, or was associated, I should say, with a slightly increased risk of dementia. This study is a little bit hot off the presses, and I hope you have a chance to dig into it in a future podcast, because these findings were really very interesting to me. The sweet spot is a normal HDL in terms of your future dementia risk. There's some confounder in there that I'll be curious to see.
I'm a little skeptical. What about low vitamin D? I thought low vitamin D was associated with dementia.
I just threw that in there. It wasn't studied in this particular...
Very tricky of you.
It's always the correct answer,
Very good. Hey, thanks everyone for listening. Again, if you want online IFP education webpage, go to ifp.com to get credit. And we hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends, rate us on iTunes, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.